Okay, so today we begin chapter 9 of free will. And again, over the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at this doctrine and how important it is. But I also, if you read the email, I sent out a link to the share drive and mentioned that there was a lecture in the audio file by Dr. James Dolezal that I believe will be very helpful if you listen to that. Because most of what I'll be saying in this first part is based on his lecture and his article. Dealing with providence and the nature of evil, and how all that fits together to be able to understand and glean from it. But Dr. James Dolezal is very gifted in that he can take very complex philosophical and theological concepts, and he's able to break them down in a way that I think can be pretty easy to understand. So I would highly encourage you to listen to that. Okay, and one more thing. When talking about God's sovereignty and free will, in our responsibility, there is mystery. There's mystery. You know, we're not going to resolve all of the questions that we have in this discussion. What we can do is explain the truth that God is sovereign and that man is responsible for the choices that he makes. Okay, the Bible teaches both very clearly. God is sovereign. God is in control of all things. But yet he holds us responsible for the choices that we make. And so that's what we're going to try to endeavor to explain, to confess that. But how that all fits together, we're not gonna solve the riddle and the mystery. There's a certain point we can't peer past the veil, right? Man is responsible, and we're free in some sense. You know, don't get too scared about the term free will, right? It's obviously a chapter in a Reformed confession. And one of the questions that, you know, one of the playful questions I put on the handout was, were you surprised to find a chapter of free will in a Reformed confession? Because usually the caricature is that people who hold a Reformed theology don't believe in freedom of the will. Now, we may not confess it and believe it in a way that others do. We believe that we hold a biblical and Reformed view of freedom of the will. But it's something that's very important and that Reformed theologians have spilled a lot of ink on, and it's something that we confess. We just need to understand it biblically and not in some pagan or Arminian way. So, Dr. Dolezal starts his lecture by saying that every Christian faces the perennial challenge of accounting for God's providence in the face of evil. Right? God is in control, but there's evil. Right? Both realities are attested by Scripture. Right? There's evil in the world and God is sovereign. Psalm 103:19 declares, the Lord has established his throne in the heavens and his kingdom rules over all. In Ephesians 1:11, we are informed that God works all things after the counsel of his will. Yet Genesis 6:5 speaks of widespread moral evil among mankind, right? Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. In Matthew 5:19, Jesus speaks of the depth of human depravity, right? For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, slanders. So then the question is, how can God be the all good and all wise universal sovereign and yet evil still abound in the world? And concerning moral evil in particular, would not God's universal providence, right, his control of all things, wouldn't that somehow implicate him in the wickedness of fallen angels and men? Right? That's the question. If he's sovereign and there's evil and we commit wickedness, how is he not implicated? How is he not responsible for that? So in order to account for evil and yet excuse God, right? Some say that God's sovereignty and his work of providence must be limited in order to make space, right? For angelic and human free agency, right? Free will to function independently of God, right? Some people make that case. In order for God not to be implicated and then for us to be responsible, somehow we must be independent of God. I don't think we want to go that route. So others try to answer the question by denying altogether the genuine causal agency of creatures, right? Arguing that every causal operation in the universe is exclusively the will of God. Some just own it. Some say, you know what? We don't really cause or do anything. It's all God. Some people argue that way. Some people say that there's no such thing as true creaturely causal agency, right? We don't cause anything. Well, I think that Dr. Dolezal rightly concludes that both of these approaches, right, saying that somehow the creature is independent of God, at least when it comes to his will, or that God is really doing all things and everything. I think that Dr. Doles already concludes that both of these approaches do not satisfactorily square with the witness of Scripture and what the Scriptures teach. And we still want to uphold Scripture's teaching that God is not the author of evil, right? The author of sin, to utilize the language of the confession. And we'll go on to explain later what exactly is meant by denying that God is the author of evil and sin. So here I would like to reiterate another point, one that I've said before, right? And that's the caution that, you know, I've brought up in the past, that right, it's easy to run to declare difficult questions that are raised by the Scriptures as insoluble paradoxes, right? Or raising contradictions, right? That the Scriptures raise these contradictions and that they cannot be solved, right? I remember we need to be cautious about saying the Scriptures contradict each other, right? I believe Dr. Dolezal is right, and he warns Christians in failing to seek an understanding of our faith through the right contemplation of what God has revealed in Scripture and disclosed in the created order, right? If the Scriptures provides answers to these difficult questions, and I believe that they do, right, we ought to search and mine the Scriptures, right, and not be satisfied with these apparent contradictions and paradoxes. Yes, there is mystery, but if one truth seems to contradict another truth, there has to be a resolution there, because the Scriptures do not contradict each other, right? The Scriptures provide answers to these difficult questions, and so my encouragement is that we're not trying to, again, speculate. We're trying to answer these questions because Scripture does, right? And you know, Proverbs, we have to do it in the spirit of Proverbs chapter 25, verse 2, right? It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings to search out a matter, right? Even chiefly, as Dr. Dolezal puts it, right, we have to try to avoid unworthy thoughts of God, right? And that's a worthy pursuit, right? We must try to hammer these things out because we don't want to have unworthy thoughts of God and of his nature. And so we need to put our theological thinking caps on and not dive into theological escapism, which a lot of Christians do sometimes, right? Well, that's not really important. That's just splitting hairs. We hear that all the time, right? But we mustn't do that. And unfortunately, most Christians and some pastors do that, unfortunately. So believe me, we will know when we hit the wall of mystery, or we can go no further, and when we can't peer past the veil, but we'll try to answer some of these difficult questions. So again, like I said, I'm trying to summarize Dr. Dolezal's arguments. So this is a lecture that he gave last year at the Southern California Reformed Baptist Pastors Conference. They were going over chapter 5 of God's Providence, and his lecture on providence and evil, I think, is very, very wonderful lecture, and it also now is in print form in, I believe, the Institute of Reformed Baptist Seminary's journal. They print out a journal every year with different peer-reviewed articles, and he turned his lecture into an article and was easier to digest, and it's very helpful. Let's see if I can try to get a PDF of that, because sometimes it's easier to read and understand something than to actually listen to the lecture sometimes. Let's start by looking at chapter 5 of the confession. It deals with, so here's a quick outline of his argument, right? He talks about an observation on God's providence in general, specifically his preservation of all things, right? And then he talks about God's and man's causal operations and how those things don't cancel each other out, right? God acts and we act. Some people seem to think that there's this notion that they cancel each other out. That's really not how things work. That's really not how we live in the world. His acting and our acting, they don't cancel each other out. Rather, they, if we can use this word, cooperate. But we still have to qualify what that means. So God and man's causal operations and how they do not cancel each other out, right? That's called the doctrine of divine concurrence. The doctrine of divine concurrence. And then we'll look at volitional free agency, right? Free will. In light of all this discussion, and then we will look at the nature of evil in light of divine concurrence. Okay, so observations on God's providence generally, right? I think it would be beneficial to start with, again, chapter 5 of the confession that deals with God's providence. So It says here, God, the good creator of all things, in his infinite power and wisdom, does uphold, direct, dispose, and govern all creatures and things, from the greatest even to the least, by his most wise and holy providence, to the end for which they are created, according unto his infallible foreknowledge, and the free and immutable counsel of his own will, to the praise of the glory of his wisdom, power, justice, and infinite goodness and mercy. God, in Isaiah 46:10, says that he is the one declaring the end from the beginning. He is the one declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. In Psalm 135, verse 6, we read, whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and in the earth, in the seas and in all deeps. In Hebrews 1:3, it says that Jesus is the one who upholds all things by the word of his power. Colossians 1:17, it says that Jesus is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And so all that we have is from God, right? He giveth to all life and breath and all things, as it says in Acts 17, verse 25, and in Revelation 4:11, right? It declares that you are worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for you created all things, and by your will, they exist and were created. Dr. Dolezal notes that the scriptures speak of God's preservation of creatures and his creation, and that it speaks of that work most fundamentally with respect to the act of existence. Right? We exist, right? And he sustains our existence. Right? He makes, I know it's odd to speak this way, but he makes creatures to be. He makes creatures to be. So, all of our actions, right, as his creatures, who he makes to be, all of our actions depend on our existence. I mean, that's pretty clear, right? Right? We are comfortable with admitting the fact that our existence is not dependent on us, right? It depends on God, and God has to sustain that. We're comfortable saying that, right? But our acting, our willing. We can't will and we can't act if we don't exist. Does that make sense, right? If we don't exist, we don't act, we don't will. Okay? So our willing is dependent on our existing. Our acting is dependent on our existing. God sustains and preserves and upholds our existence so that it follows that he upholds and sustains our acting, our willing. Does that make sense? Okay. Right? Our existence is not of ourselves, right? It's derived from God, and our acting is not of ourselves. Our acting is not of ourselves. It's dependent upon God. No creature exists independently from God, and everyone acknowledges this, but people struggle to accept that we do not act independently from God. We don't. But our acting is based upon our existing. Right? And so again, nobody accuses God of violating our willing, our nature, because he makes us exist. Who makes that argument? Nobody does, right? Is it God is violating my will, my nature, by causing me to be? Who says that? Nobody does. Nobody complains that God sustains your existence. The issue is, God sustains your acting and your willing. And that's where people have a problem. Right? But he has to also do that. Because our acting and willing is dependent upon our existence. And so if God sustains our existence, he sustains our willing and our acting. God makes us to be, and God does not violate us when he makes us to act. And this is a very, very important point. Okay, so some might object that God must continue to provide his causing us to be, right? So God must provide us with existence, but he has to let go in some way, right? And so the analogy usually is given that some things in nature work that way. I know it's getting really technical, but some things in nature work that way, right? Consider heat, right? And a pot. Right? Heat, energy, it heats up a pot, right? And by its nature, it transfers its nature, heat, right, to the pot, right? The pot then takes in the heat and makes it a part of its nature in some way, but then it'll dissipate once you remove the heat, right? Well, some people want to argue that God must do that with our existence, that he must give us our existence, but then he has to stop sustaining that somehow, and we somehow take existence into our very nature. But we can't say that, because God is the only one who exists in and of himself. We can't do that. If God takes away his sustaining of our existence, poof, we're gone. He has to continue to sustain that. And so some argue that way because they see in nature that sometimes happens. Things or causes cause other things to be, right? And that thing that's made to be, that's caused, takes in some of that nature. Like I gave you the example of heat. And people say that it must be that way. It must be that way when it comes to our existence. Well, that's very problematic. In creatures, the act of existence does not become part of our nature. It can't. Right? As Thomas Aquinas says, no thing can remain in being if divine operation ceases. In other words, if God stops sustaining your existence, you stop existing. We cannot exist by ourselves. We are not ase. God is ase of himself, right? Only God is from himself. Therefore, creatures require God's continual operation of making us to be. If he were to withdraw that, there would be nothing but God, who exists of himself. God's and man's causal operations and how they do not cancel each other out. This is the doctrine of divine concurrence, right? So let's remember the facets of God's divine providence, right? He preserves, right? He conserves. That's another way of saying it. He governs his creation. And one that's usually not discussed, but that's very important and relevant to our discussion, is this doctrine of concurrence, right? Sometimes called cooperation, right? In some sense, God acts and we act and we cooperate. We need to qualify what we mean by that, but we cooperate with God, right? He's an actor. We're actors. He acts, we act. And they don't cancel each other out. Rather, they work together in some sense. Not on the same footing, right? But they work together. And that's the doctrine of divine concurrence, right? Let's talk about conservation, right? Francis Turin says, conservation is that by which God conserves all creatures in their own state, which is done by a conservation of essence in the species of existence in individuals and of virtues to their operations. Government is that by which God governs universals and singulars and directs and draws them out to ends for appointed by him. So that's conservation and that's government, right? Okay, so discussing and meditating on the doctrine of cooperation or divine concurrence, I believe, helps us to defend against two prevalent and wrong views of God's providence. We've discussed these before, right? But I'll mention them here in brief. Okay, so this doctrine of divine concurrence that says that God is an actor and an agent and is causing things, and we are also, in some sense, causing things to happen, right? We're secondary causes. He's the first cause. And our acting doesn't cancel out God's, and God doesn't cancel us ours out, right? So this doctrine of divine concurrence helps us to not fall into these two errors, right? So deism seeks to eliminate God's causal activity continuing on in the world so that it does not cancel out natural causes and the causing of other creatures, right? So remember the analogy of the watchmaker, right? They say that God's a watchmaker. He makes a watch. He winds it up, right? And then he lets it go and he steps back. And so the world and its creatures are all acting independently of God. God just stepped away and he's no longer involved, right? That's deism, right? And some people argue that way because they're not comfortable with the fact that God acting and our acting somehow can work together. They say it has to be one or the other. Either God has to act or we have to act. There can't be cooperation. There can't be. And so people go the route of deism. To say that God, just creates the world, causes it to be by natural laws, right? And essentially, he makes creatures to self-exist and be independent, little gods, doing all the causing now. That's what deists believe. That's what their view logically leads to. So this view has cropped up in history throughout all of man's religious activity, right? This is actually the view of the pagan gods, right? Right? What are the pagan gods? Right? It's the gods are simply just more powerful beings than you, right? And they still have to compete, right, with other gods. And they have to compete with human beings, right? They may be more powerful, but they still have to in some way share power with all other creatures. And so that's the view of most of the pagan religions. So again, this amounts to just seeing God as merely just competing with human beings and with other creatures, right? God in this picture is nothing more than a competitor, not the first cause, and certainly not the governor and sustainer of all, but a finite power that either must overpower others, right? Or he has to ask them to cooperate with him and cooperate on the same level, right? I need your help. Right? And we see this throughout all the Greek myths and whatever. So that's deism. Okay, the next false view is pantheism, right? The opposite view, right? So in deism, God steps away, and so there's independent creatures, self-existing and causing, and God is not involved in causing anything in the world. The other extreme view is pantheism, right? We see the opposite extreme, that all there is divine agency and causing, and this view no longer acknowledges genuine non-divine causes, right? In other words, you're not acting. You're not willing. Nobody here is really acting. This is all just an illusion. Really, God is the one acting. All there is God acting. Everything is God. Right? That's pantheism. Everything is God. All is God. And so the world that we see and experience is an illusion, and simply God just actualizing himself, right? If no creature is genuinely causing anything, then God alone is the immediate cause of both good and evil, right? If it's all God acting, then there's no distinction between good and evil. There's no moral culpability or responsibility in that view. You're just God acting. How can you be held responsible? That's pantheism. So one major wrong assumption that both of these views share, as Dr. Dolezal points out, is that both views share the common belief that God and the creature cannot both be causal agents producing the exact same effect. In short, to the extent God acts causally, the creature does not. And to the extent that the creature acts causally, God does not. But that's wrong. That's a wrong view. The assumption is that both humans and God cannot cooperate to produce the same effect. They both say it has to be one or the other. It cannot be both. The biblical view is that it's both. But we'll unpack that a little bit more. A biblical view of divine concurrence, cooperation, will help us to see both God and man act together to produce the exact same effect. Case in point, the crucifixion. It's very clear that God holds Pontius Pilate, Herod, the Gentiles, the Israelites. They desire to do what they wanted to do, but God, in his wisdom from before time, ordained the death of Christ. So to reiterate, when God causes us to be, he must sustain that act, because the act of existence does not become one with our nature, right? We explain that. God is the only self-existent. He is the only I say, right? He is the I am who I am. So that is indeed the case. then you cannot separate our acting from his immediate causing of our existence, right? Some people try to do that. God causes us to exist, but he doesn't cause us to act. Well, no, those two are related, and they cannot be separated. And if you're comfortable with God making you to be, then you have to be comfortable with God sustaining you to act, right? So we have our being in motion from him. And that's what the scriptures say, right? We act, we cause other things to be. We are secondary causes, but he is the ultimate first cause, and we're ultimately dependent on God, right? He's no more violating our nature when he causes us to act than when he causes us to be. That's what we have to get that. We have to get that. So the causing of God and the causing of men do not neglect or cancel each other out. This alignment of created causes is what the doctrine of divine concurrence is aiming to explain. Our causing is dependent upon his causing. So that's the key. We cooperate, right? When we think of cooperation, we usually think of things being on the same level, right? But that's the case between us, right? You're a person and a human being, and so am I, and we work together, and you know, we're on the same footing, at least by nature. We're both human beings, and so we cooperate. When we speak of God cooperating with man, we still have to understand and heavily qualify that this cooperation is still, it's very clear that though we act and he acts, our acting is dependent upon him. In other words, if me and Eric tried to move a boat onto the shore, right, in as much as you're pushing, I'm not pushing, and in as much as I'm pushing, you're not pushing. In other words, we even each other out, right? And my pushing is not dependent upon your pushing in some sense, right? You're not sustaining my strength, my pushing. But in our acting, in our moving, God has to give us that power. And our acting and moving is dependent upon that. So we cooperate in some sense, but we have to remember that ultimately it all is dependent upon God. We're not on the same level. We're not both actors of the same level. Does that make sense? Okay. Here's a helpful quote by Dr. James Dolezal. All non-divine powers, me and you, all non-divine powers of operation and agency are caused causes or moved movers. It's strange to speak that way, but it's pithy. You're a moved mover. You move things, but God has to move you. You cause things, but you've been caused to be, right? All nine divine powers of operation, agency, are causes or moved movers. These are often referred to as secondary causes in distinction to God, who is the primary cause of all things. As our confession says, 2 London chapter 5, paragraph 2 states, God providentially orders the affairs of the world, even those that appear to us to be chance events, right? They appear to us to be chance. And they fall out in accordance with the nature of secondary causes, whether necessary, free, or contingent. God's work of ordinary providence does not hover above the natural order of cause and effect, but rather runs straight through it. God is not hovering over creation, right, and looking how things cause and make other things to be. No, rather, all of that has to depend on God's power. And so he's not hovering above his creation. He's running through it, in, over it, all over it, in and out, inside and everything. Right? And we must remember that this cooperation is a subordinate cooperation. If we're going to talk about cooperating with God, it's subordinate cooperation. It depends on God. Our acting and existence depend on God. Our acting depends on him. Romans 11:36. For from him, and through him, and to him, are all things. Let's talk about volitional free agency, free will, in this context. Okay, so some want to argue, in order for us to be free and responsible, that God cannot cause or act or operate in as much as we will, right? Does that make sense? Like, if God's willing, he has to suspend that to make room for our willing, and then only then we can be responsible, and God is not responsible, right? But again, there's problems with that. In other words, God somehow does not suspend his operation of sustaining existence, but he suspends his operation of movement in the creature when it comes to willing. Therefore, he's off the hook, right? So some argue that. Some don't want to argue, rightly so, they shouldn't, that God has to suspend his sustaining our existence, right? He doesn't do that. If he did, we'd be gone. Poof, gone, right? So he doesn't suspend that, right? But people say, but he has to suspend his causing us to act and to will. But, and so in some sense, we're independent from God. But that's problematic. But people argue that way to get God off the hook. But we know that though existence and acting are inseparable. Existence and acting are inseparable. Our acting depends on our existence. And God sustains our existence. He sustains our acting. So then how are we free to act and be morally responsible, but not devolve into, as Dolzal puts it, an operational atheism? That's essentially what it comes down to, right? It's an operational atheism. If we think that God has to somehow not support our acting and our willing, then in some sense we're functioning kind of like there is no God, at least when it comes to our willing. Does that make sense? If it makes sense, then it's a problem. But we can first give a biblical witness to God's working in the production of evil and natural causes. Some of these verses might make us uncomfortable. God is the one forming light and creating darkness, causing well-being and creating calamity. I am the Lord who does all these. Right? God forms swarms of locusts to devour crops in Amos 7:1 and sends destruction upon the earth by means of fire. Psalm 104, verse 32, Amos 9:5. And Psalm 104:6, Amos 9:6, right? Right, okay, so we're comfortable with the natural disasters that happen in the world and saying that God is causing those things, right? Maybe some aren't, but most Christians, I believe, they're comfortable with that. Well, of course God controls those things, and he makes those things to happen for his holy and good purposes. Remember, when we think of God's providence, we can't divorce his goodness. We have to look at his goodness. We have to keep that always in mind, okay? And so we're comfortable with natural disasters, and God controls those things. Well, what about the evil of moral agents like men and angels? Does God, in some sense, control those things? Is sovereign over those things? Well, the Lord puts a deceiving spirit in the mouths of false prophets. 1 Kings 22, chapters 19 to 23. He hardens Pharaoh's heart, Exodus 9:12, as well as the hearts of other persons. Joshua 11:20, John 12:40, Romans 9:18. And then, of course, our Lord's crucifixion, right? For truly in this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. And all of those people were held responsible for what they did. So the scriptures are clear that God is the one working all things in accordance with his sovereign decree and purpose, and that includes working the wicked actions of creatures that they will. So this is not a bare permission. Remember, the confession denies that God just, you know, permits things. Right? It's not a bare permission. God isn't stepping back. So people say God's stepping back and human beings filling in the void, right? He has to step back. And then we fill that void with our willing, right? But that can't happen because we can't be independent like that, right? And see, some people argue that way again to excuse God. But that's why we confess in chapter 5, paragraph 4, right? That God doesn't just barely, you know, he doesn't permit things with a bare permission. God brings about evil. We cannot, so this is a very important distinction. God brings about evil, but he does not do evil. We cannot say he does evil. God brings about evil. We cannot say he does evil. So it's the bringing about of evil that we need to address. How does this happen? How does this happen? What is evil and how does it come to be? What is the nature of evil, right? And again, that's not a contradiction, that God brings about evil but does not commit any evil or injustice in doing that. And some people are like, that's really uncomfortable. Well, what is evil? The short answer is that evil is the absence of good where good ought to be. It is a privation of good and a failure to hit the mark. It is not a substantial thing that exists in its own right. In other words, evil, sin, is not some substance in the world. It's not some ethereal cloud hovering over things, making things happen. It's not an actual thing. It's the lack of goodness. It's the lack of goodness where good ought to be. A privation of good and a failure to hit the mark. Right? And so if we will, against the law of God, choose to do evil, that want or that lacking of the good, our deviation from what is good, right? What is sin? Sin is transgressing God's law, right? That deviation is not from God, it's from us. That deviation is from us, which is not a thing, right? Evil is not a thing, but it's a missing the mark, and that is what is evil, and that is from us. And it is from God in some sense, because he makes and sustains the good, right? He makes and sustains our acting, right? And remember, I think we went over this when we spoke of God's providence, right? He sustains our actions, right? And that's a good thing for him to do, right? It's in our nature to be able to act and to will. And so, of course, he has to sustain that. That is what the good that he does, right? The good in being able to move my hands, right? And to be able to freely grab an object, right? God sustains all of that, and all of that is good. But if I were to move my hands and grab a rock and then smash someone over the face with it to kill them, all of that acting is good in the sense that God sustains, right? There's nothing wrong or evil with me moving my arm or hands or picking up an object in and of itself. But what is the evil? I transgress against God's law, right? That's key. So evil is not a thing. It's a deviation from God's law. And that deviation resides in me, not God. See how God can sustain my acting and can control evil, but the evil is not from God. It is from us. Evil in light of divine concurrence. The sinfulness of sin is not in the being or movement of sinful creatures. Otherwise, we could rightly charge God with its authorship, insomuch as all creatures move and have their being immediately and through God. Rather, sinfulness lies in the absence of moral good that angels and humans ought to seek and perform. Right? That's key. That is what is meant by God not being the author of sin. That the confession says that God is not the author of sin. Though our existence and movement are dependent upon God, sin's genesis, sin's beginning, and remember that sin is not an actual thing or substance or matter, but it's a deprivation. We are responsible for that. So that is how God can sustain our acting, right? Because it's good for him to do that. He's not violating our nature to do that. But the deviation from the law of God and the evil that we commit, though he sustains and controls our actions, is not from God, it's from us. There's a couple more helpful quotes from his lecture. Moral evil follows from the lack of a form of goodness in a subject's will, where such good is morally expected of him or her. And this lack of good form is precisely a lack in the creature and not in God, who is goodness itself. Right? The notion of determined freedom, right? God determines the ends, but we're free. I know that that sounds contradictory. And there's no other way to explain that. Determined freedom. The notion of determined freedom will undoubtedly strike many as peculiar, and saying that God moves the creature's will so that it moves itself freely, we maintain that God causes the will to move in the way that is natural to it, right? Again, it's natural for us to move and to act, right? And he doesn't violate our will in doing that. And God doing and sustaining that is a good thing. But again, we move and we transgress against God's law. And the moving itself is not evil, but our deviation from the law of God is, and that's from us. Yet, in so much as man freely wills some good, there is no evil in his action. It is only in the falling short of his obligation to will other or higher goods that his will is rendered evil. The fact that God moves this evil will does not mean that God creates evil in it. Right? He moves the evil will, but the evil will is from us, and God does not create evil in doing that. Evil is rather the result of what is not in the angels or the humans' will, at least according to the privation account. And what's the privation account? God is not obligated to give good form to all willing, right? Now that's where some of the mystery lies, right? Because God, if he wanted to, could sustain your will to do that only which was good. But he doesn't. He didn't do it in the case of Adam. That's the mystery. Or one of them. Some might say, and this is not in my notes, but some might say that the possibility for evil was good. Because in some sense, it allowed for God to display all of his attributes in some sense, right? How is a flame more appreciated, right? Is it appreciated in a well-lit room or in the pitch black darkness of the night? Right? Flame is more vivid against the backdrop of darkness. So how can God still find fault? Right? His causing and our causing are not in competition, right? As some people imagine it, right? As, you know, they consider something like a drunk driver in a car accident, right? And they blame the alcohol, right? Or something else, or another driver, right? Right? And that's how things are in the natural world, right? Those causes, but remember, those causes do not sustain and cause other causes. The car is not sustaining my existence. Some other driver is not causing me to be. So we can't really think of God's causing and acting in the same way, right? So we cannot conceive of our moral responsibility as in the case of natural causes, where one or the other would be more responsible, right? In that case, something would be more responsible, either the other driver or the drunk driver. But we can't conceive of it in that way. God moves us, and if he is free to withhold the good from a man such that evil results and then judges that, then he's free to do so because that man belongs to him and serves his purpose. And that's the argument that Paul makes in Romans 9. Now we get to paragraph 1. I know that all of that was very technical. If you have questions, email me, and I highly encourage you to listen to that lecture. He does a much better job than I could explaining these things. But we have to talk about God's providence and him causing us to act and to will, because that's where people get hung up, I think. I hope that maybe was helpful, right? How God can sustain our acting, but yet the evil of our acting is from us and not from God. That's how God is not held responsible. He's not the author of evil. Rather, we are the ones who commit the evil. Evil is not something, it's not a substance, it's not a thing of matter that's walking around manipulating people. It's a failure to do the good and the transgressing of God's law. Now, paragraph 1 of chapter 9, right? This is a short and concise paragraph. Right, God hath endued the will of man with that natural liberty and power of acting upon choice, that it is neither forced nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. It's short and concise, but it's packed with a lot of theological and philosophical concepts we need to wrestle with and try to understand. Paragraph 1 states a general understanding and definition of the freedom of the will, following the pattern that we have seen in the confession, right? Right. The first paragraph of a chapter lays out the doctrine generally, right? And then what follows is a further explanation of the various facets of that doctrine. And here's a helpful outline of chapter 9. It's from Dr. Waldron's exposition of the Second London. So this outline, paragraph 1 deals with the definition of human freedom. And then paragraphs 2 through 5 deals with the states of human freedom, right? And then there's the right, there's the state of innocency, right? Free will and the state of innocency. We'll take that up next week in paragraph 2, along with paragraph 3, free will in the state of sin. And then free will in the state of grace, when God regenerates us, paragraph 4, and then free will in the state of glory, paragraph 5. And here's another helpful outline, simpler one. All right, paragraph 1 deals with its natural liberty. Paragraph 2 deals with its original instability. Paragraph 3, its fallen inability. Paragraph 4, its renewed ability. Paragraph 5, its ultimate immutability. Our focus is drawn to God, our Creator. Right? God, our Creator, and echoes and assumes the chapters that have come before. Right? Of God and of the Holy Trinity, remember. Chapter 2, God who is most holy, most wise, most free, working all things according to the counsel of his own immutable and most righteous will. And this is perhaps an imprecise manner of speaking of both the human will and the divine will, but if ever they were in opposition, right, as natural forces and material objects can be sometimes, right, if they were ever to collide, as I think R.C. Sproul ever said, who would win out? So, there's that. Our God is working all things for his own glory, and he is most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth. I'm just going over some of the previous chapters to get to this point, right? Because God is spoken of here and assumes everything that we've said about God, right? And he is most loving, gracious, merciful, long-suffering, abundant in goodness and truth, a God who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. And we must never lose sight of that, right? Especially when we speak of God's rule over us and our freedom of will, which this good and gracious God has blessed us with. He has, as it says here, God has endued us with. He has provided us with this ability. But yet he hath most sovereign dominion over all creatures to do by them, for them, or upon them whatsoever himself pleaseth. God is not the author of sin, as we confess, as we discussed in his confession chapter 3. He establishes the liberty and contingency of second causes. We're second causes, right, in the world. And we're free, in some sense. And yet, God decrees all that is to happen and disposes all things in wisdom to accomplish that decree. And he does so freely and apart from the creature. He does not take in knowledge, right? He does not see our acting. He doesn't see our choosing and down the corridors of time, right? And then in response to our acting and our choosing, he then acts and chooses and he's reacting. God does not react. That's not the way that God decrees things. He doesn't see what's going to happen and then react. No, no, no. Things happen the way that they happen because God decrees. And that's how he knows all things. He's the one who decreed it. In his providence, he upholds, directs, governs all creatures for the end for which they were created. And we must never lose sight of his goodness when speaking of his providence. It's a good God, a kind God, a merciful God who directs, disposes all things. And we must never lose sight of that. He is good and just and holy. There's nothing that happens by chance or fortune, and all that does come to pass. And he governs all of it. Remember that he ordereth them to fall out all things according to the nature of second causes, either necessarily, freely, or contingently. And that's so important. He doesn't violate our natures in causing us to act any more than is causing us to exist and sustaining that existence does. And in causing us to act, sin and the sinfulness of the act proceeds from the creature and not from God, as it says in chapter 5, verse 4. Adam willfully transgressed the law of God, chapter 6, paragraph 1. We willfully choose to transgress and sin. We are not coerced or forced. So God has created us and endued the will of man and gifted us and given us a natural liberty and power of acting upon choice. Remember that we are speaking of the will generally here. We're speaking of the will generally, right? This no doubt leads into the discussion that paragraph 2 takes up, right? And it speaks of Adam in his state of innocency. Right, where he had the freedom and power to will, right, and to do that which pleased God, But Adam was created in a state that was mutable. He could change. He could fall away from that. He could do that which was good and pleasing to God, but he could also choose to sin. And now the mystery is, well, God, why didn't just God sustain him in his goodness to do nothing but good, kind of like what we will experience in heaven, where God sustains and changes our will so that we only do that which is good? Why didn't he do that then? And why does he do that now? So we'll try to unpack Adam's state in innocency next week. But here we're speaking of freedom of will in general, a natural liberty and power of acting upon choice. What do we mean by will? I'm throwing some more Latin terms, but I'm defining the English, okay? Why do we study Latin and why do we use Latin terms? Some pastors, some teachers say you shouldn't do that. No, this is the language of theology. For 1500 years, the church did theology in this language. So if we have to understand things like will and God and things like asse, we have to define and understand these Latin terms. We have to. This is what the reformers breathed. So I'm just taking us a step back. Yes, we'll get to the English, but we have to understand that they're based in all this theological language are based on Latin and Greek words that were used to do theology. Okay? Voluntas, will, right? Will is the faculty. What's a faculty? It's an inherent mental or physical power of will resident. What resident? A thing that resides, a quality that is present or inherent in something, right? The will, the faculty of will resident by nature in all spiritual beings, the appetitive power of a spiritual being, right? And that gets us to what appetite is. Appetitus, appetite, desire. Capacity of a being which seeks out or inclines towards a good, right, when it's not deformed by sin, naturally, right, which seeks out or inclines towards a good, the exercise of the will implies appetite. And all of these terms are tied together and related, which is why I'm giving them to you to help us understand the will, at least how it's been discussed in scholastic and reformed theology. And so will and appetite relate to what's called the intellect. The intellect, intellectus, intellect, understanding, the faculty of the soul that knows, makes, or passes judgment. And assents, right? What is assent? To agree to something after thoughtful consideration, right? It assents to the truth of what it knows. Intellect conjoins, right? Joins or combines for a common purpose. Intellect conjoins with will and human free choice, presenting the will with objects and with judgments concerning their theoretical, practical goodness, acceptability, or usefulness. So, helpful distinction here. The will desires the goodness, truth, and justice known by the intellect. So that's the difference. What is the difference between the intellect and the will? The intellect is where the knowledge resides. We make judgments, right? And desires come from there, and then we act upon those desires. Now remember, we're speaking of the will generally. We're not considering the fall yet. We're not considering redemptive grace. We're speaking of that natural liberty. That natural liberty and power of acting upon choice. Liberty of nature is the liberty that is proper to a being given its particular nature. No being, not even omnipotent God, can act contrary to its nature. God does not act contrary to its nature. And do we? No, we don't. So that's the context that we have to understand the liberty of the will. It's free, but it's confined to its nature, to our nature. Right? I would very much like to be able to teleport to the supermarket or to fly there. But it's not in my nature to do that. Right? Am I not free? I can get in my car and drive there. I'm free. Or I can choose not to go. I'm free. But it's limited by my nature. This is the full fourth state of man. Right? We have to understand our nature in these states. And these are very helpful. But I don't think we have time to go over all of them, but we'll go through them as we go through all of the paragraphs. And this is what all of the subsequent or the following paragraphs get into, right? The liberty of Adam, right? Right? He was able not to sin. The liberty of the freedom of sinners, right? We're not able, this is a double negative. We're not able not to sin when we're sinners and unregenerate, right? And there's the freedom of the faithful once we have been regenerated, right? The term is posse peccare et non peccare, which is able to sin, and we're able not to sin, right? That's our regenerated state. We sin, and we cannot, and we can choose not to sin. And then, of course, the liberty of glory, non posse peccare, we are in glory, we will be unable to sin. So again, the next lesson will expound all of the fourfold state. What's important to understand is our natural liberty is confined by our nature even before the fall. It's not an unrestricted, freedom of the will, as some people believe, contrary to our nature, whatever state it finds itself in, right? And Richard Mueller in his dictionary is very helpful. He says that people are accordingly free to will according to their nature, the nature being determined by the human condition, whether unfallen, fallen into sin, in grace, or in glory, right? That's what we're free in. So we have a natural liberty, a liberty of our wills that is suited to our nature. That's what freedom of the will means. It's a liberty of our wills that is suited to our nature. And that doesn't mean that we can do whatever we want. And it doesn't mean that we can, in some states, it means that we can't do the good. But some Christians would have you believe that in some states, in all states, you can always do the good. Nope, that's not the biblical witness. So we have a natural liberty, a liberty of our wills that is suited to our nature, and with that, the power of acting upon choice. And that power of choice does not change even throughout our different states. Here is a helpful illustration by J.B. Fesco. I like this illustration. It's the one in the prison cell. Right, okay. Here's where we must distinguish freedom of the will and freedom of choice. Two very different ideas. Because of the fall, we have lost our freedom of the will, the voluntas. Our wills are bound to sin, but we have not lost the librum arbitrium, freedom of choice. Think of someone who commits a crime and then they're in prison, right? They have lost their freedom of will because they are stuck in this cell, but in the confines of this cell, they are free to choose a number of things. Maybe I can lie down in my cot. Maybe I can watch TV. Maybe I can read a book. I can't go to Disneyland, right? Because I'm in this cell. They have lost their freedom of will because they are stuck in this cell. But in the confines of this cell, they are free to choose a number of things. Free to choose within the confines of that cell. That is the nature of sin. We've lost our freedom of will, the ability to will that which is good. We are confined to sinful things. And of course, we'll discuss that paragraph 3 where it speaks of our fallen nature, and then how our will acts in that. We'll unpack that more when we deal with paragraph 3. But whatever state we are in, we have a freedom of choice, even if our choices are limited by that very state of nature we find ourselves in. And in every state we find ourselves in, the will can be viewed as essentially free and unconstrained, but nonetheless limited by its own nature or natural capacity in choosing particular things and in view of the restricting and debilitating effects of sin. Remember, the will is neither forced nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. And we'll end with this. The will is not forced. God does not drag people to make choices they do not want to. There is nothing outside of man, nothing without, that coerces the will to either good or evil. Now, and some people think that that's not reformed. Wait a minute, that sounds like Arminian to me. No, it's not. If you think if you think this is not reformed theology, you are mistaken. I'm sorry, but there's a lot of Calvinists that don't know what they're talking about. I don't even like to use the term Calvinist. It's reformed theology. And some people have bought into this caricature of reformed theology. Now, yes, we have to heavily qualify what we mean by freedom of the will, but our will is not forced or coerced. We're not puppets. We're not robots. That's the caricature that Arminians and pagans view Reformed theology. But Reformed theology upholds a freedom of the will, a freedom of choice, that says that our will is not forced or coerced, but it's limited by its nature. That's key. The will is not determined to do good or evil by necessity of nature. In other words, our will is not made to move as the laws of nature do, like gravity, right? Certain things play out by necessity in the world, right? Because God has designed it that way, right? I drop a ball and it falls, right? The law of gravity, God has built that into the world and he controls all that, right? Without direct intervention and superseding the normal means he has established, as he does in the case of miracles, God has designed and moves the world in such a way that if one thing happens, something else will by necessity happen. Case in point, again, the laws of gravity, the laws of motion, the seasons, right? The law of thermodynamics, right? But the will, our will, is not governed in that way. That's what we mean by that our will is not forced by a necessity of nature. It's not like the law of gravity. I was going to go over some views of Arminianism, but I don't think we have time for that.